Lady Justice is a true crime podcast, therefore deals with incidents of violence, disturbing imagery, and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised. The Lady Justice podcast wishes to offer their deepest condolences to the victims' families and wishes to offer thanks to those that work in emergency services. Hello, lovelies, and welcome to another episode of Lady Justice, a true crime podcast. Lady Justice is a weekly podcast that covers fascinating cases from both the past and the present. My name is Chantelle, and I'm your friendly true crime junkie with slight caffeine addiction issues. I hope this episode finds you all feeling fantastic and that you've had a brilliant week. As usual, before I get into this episode, I do want to ask you guys a massive favour. Please support this podcast by subscribing, rating, and leaving a review where you can. And because sharing is caring, I want you to tell everyone you know. Share it on social media and get the word out. It makes the world of difference. If you'd like to contact me about anything at all, please feel free to do so via social media or by my email, which you'll find in the show notes. I would also like to take the time to remind you that the biggest true crime weekend is coming to London in June 2021, CrimeCon UK in partnership with Crime and Investigation. It's going to be a weekend filled with talks, interactive activities, and some of the best known faces in the genre, along with folk like Eileen and Charlie from Crime Lapse, Emily from Morbidology, and Jonna Law from Who Killed Teresa. I will be on podcast row. I am super excited, and listeners of the show can get an exclusive discount on ticket prices with the code LADY. You'll get your 10% off. I'd love to see you there, and we can all have a drink in the bar after, I promise. I'm also very excited to announce that there will be a giveaway if you listen to the end of the show for tickets to CrimeCon's house arrest event later this month. This week, before the Act of Kindness, we have a promo for one of my top 5 true crime podcasts, Murder and Such. Now, the host, Hunter, is a wonderfully brilliant storyteller with a voice perfect for podcasting. There's never a bad episode, and I can say that for everyone I've ever recommended the show to, they've loved it. So I'm honoured to have his promo play a little later in the show. But on to this week's episode. On a summer's evening, teenage sweethearts were taking a walk down a lover's lane until gunshots rang out over the secluded spot. This is the case, Glaring Eyes. So, without further ado, here is some of the background on the location and timeframe of this case. We are heading back to the year 1935, when King George V was to celebrate his Silver Jubilee as monarch. It was the year that saw Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald leave office due to retirement, and Stanley Baldwin take the lead. 1935 saw driving tests in the UK become compulsory, Penguin Books founded, and A Clergyman's Daughter by George Orwell published. Famous folk to be born this year include Johnny Kidd and Michael Parkinson. Deaths that made the headlines include T.E. Lawrence, Princess Victoria, and the subject of episode Femme Fatale, Frances Rattenbury. We are taking a trip up to Perth, a city in central Scotland, and I can't believe it's taken me this long to get to Scotland. It's such a pretty old city, which hosts many culturally significant places, and it has one damn fine accent to boot. A major crime that happened within the city is when King James I was murdered by his very own uncle. Famous folk with connections to the city include my childhood crush, Ewan McGregor, the poo lady off the telly, Gillian McKeith, and the former Secretary of State for Defence, Sir Michael Fallon. As always, all my sources will be listed in the show notes. On the outskirts of Perth is a secluded beauty spot, surrounded by farmland and woods. The perfect spot for those entering courtship to get some alone time without prying eyes. A Lover's Lane. Now, for the city of Perth, the Lover's Lane was known as Cuddy's Strip, once synonymous with the great feelings of early love, after the events of this episode, it never felt the same. It was early in 1935 that a promising young footballer, Daniel Kerrigan, known as Danny, was to ask the 17-year-old Marjorie Fenwick out. Danny was a good-looking lad, with a big smile, a strong build, and at 18, he was just starting to get his footing in the world, having just started an apprenticeship as a glazer. He was a popular and sensible young man, having been a member of the Boys' Brigade, and a player for many local football teams. Still living at home with his parents at 18 Union Street, he was just beginning to find himself, and he adored his girlfriend, carrying pictures of the pair together and showing them to anyone who would look. Marjorie was a very pretty young lady, with brunette hair and piercing eyes. She'd come from a big family, being the youngest of four daughters and one son. She was a funny and popular girl, well known in the area around her family home at 8 Lower Causeway on Dovecot Lane in the city. She was an outgoing, yet responsible girl, and when she wasn't working at a confectionery manufacturer's, she was often noted as attending dances held in Perth. The young lovers had been together and were happy for around 8 months when their usual date night came around on August 12th. Danny took some extra money with him when he left home, wondering if Marjorie would like to go to the cinema. He arrived at her home at around 7 p.m, and after she said she wasn't in the mood, they went for a walk near the woods at Cuddy Strip. They took some time to sit and enjoy the lighter evening, looking at photos that Danny had with him in his brown pocketbook, showing their relationship so far. And then they decided, as the night started to draw in, they would begin their walk back home. The clock at Perth Academy rang out over the hillside as 10 p.m. came on that Wednesday, and Marjorie was cuddling into Danny as they walked, her arm wrapped around his, when another sound rang out. An echoing gunshot. It sounded like it came from behind them, just a little over 10 yards away. Marjorie gave a yelp as anyone would at an unexpected sound, and the couple span around. Then there was another shot. Then Danny fell to the floor. Marjorie screamed out. Her voice broke as she begged for assistance. She was looking down at her sweetheart and mindlessly asking what was wrong. Just as she was calling for help, a figure of a man appeared from the brushwood. Marjorie was thankful as she saw him appear, thinking they would get help. But then she looked at the man again. He wasn't there to help. Without a word, he started to make his way towards her, gathering speed. Marjorie scrambled and began to run, his eyes telling her he was danger. The young woman ran down the rough path towards the main road at Cherry Bank until she was near the historic Duplin Moor. She then was blocked by a wooden stile. Marjorie was hyper aware that the man was gaining on her, and she started to climb over it before she felt a tug against the back of her clothes and the sudden drop in her stomach as she was dragged down from her position and fell to the ground. Above her was a man with a handkerchief wrapped tightly around the bottom half of his face. She let out a scream, yet in such a secluded spot, no one heard her. The mysterious man, with glaring eyes, started to tear items of her clothing off. He then forced her arms together to the rear of her body and tied them tightly with a handkerchief, and then repeated the action at her ankles before throwing her down again. He dragged her to one side. He then assaulted her, kneeling down on her and placing pressure on her neck. Marjorie lost consciousness. When she came to an hour later, the man was gone. Her clothes were gone, and she was still tied up. In the dark, she began to struggle with her restraints, terrified that the man may come back, and desperate to know what happened to her love. Eventually, she was to free herself. It took some time for Marjorie to stand, and she found herself running. It wouldn't be long until she stumbled across some of the last lovers that were out that night. A telegraph linesman called John Spence was with his girlfriend Dorothy Ewan, and they were notably shocked when they saw Marjorie running towards them. They instantly stopped to help her, with John running back to the closest phone to call for the city police force. Dorothy tried to calm the panicked teenager and escorted her to the closest home with the lights on. When they arrived at the home of Mr. James Drummond, the assistant janitor of Perth Academy on Oakbank Terrace, she was given some clothing, as in the light, the witnesses were to see the full extent of the attack on her flesh, being covered in bruises and scratches. The issue was, the Perth City Police were not the correct police force, and there was a delay, as they had to call for the county police force. Attendances were made at the scene where Daniel was shot just after midnight. However, he wasn't in the same position that Marjorie had left him in when she'd ran away from the assailant. He'd been shot once more, this time in the head, and a handkerchief was placed over his face. The attacker had returned between his attack on Marjorie and when the police came across the scene. The search of a densely packed area in the dark was to be a hard task in 1935, but electric torches were used as the rush of the investigation started. At the police headquarters, a message was placed to all police forces across Scotland that a madman was on the loose. A cordon was set up, and every car coming in or out of the city was stopped, checked, and searched. Marjorie was spoken to, and at 2 a.m, Acting Chief Constable McPherson, Inspector Davidson, and Detective Sergeant Campbell had arrived upon the scene. Despite the efforts to search the woods and hillsides of the area, the murderer had seemingly disappeared into the night. The police surgeon, Dr. Anderson, was called, and after an examination of both Daniel and the surviving Marjorie, the girl under the demands of Mrs. Drummond, the wife of the janitor, was driven home to her mother, who was waiting for her at 4 a.m. The morning saw a bustle of activity down the Lovers' Lane as a full search of the area was conducted. Danny's body was removed from the scene and taken to the mortuary located at Greyfriars Cemetery. Officers were then sent to his home, where his mother was awaiting her son returning home. Her face filled with worry as she opened the door, and they informed her of Danny's death. They then asked whether anyone had any issues with the young man. No one did. He was very well liked. She told them she couldn't understand who would do that to her Danny. With the daylight, the county prosecutor Fiscal was to make his way to the scene and asked for the constables to search the route that the couple had taken that evening. When they were at the scene of the wooden stile and surrounding bush, they expected to find the remains of Marjorie's clothing. However, not a trace was found. The investigators assumed that the perpetrator took them as a souvenir to remember his vicious deed. Whilst those searched the moorland, Marjorie was spoken to, and she gave a description of the man who was now the talk of Perth. It was later to be relayed to the press and stated the attacker was believed to be about 30 years of age, about 5'3" or 5'4" in height. He has a reddish complexion, flattish nose, staring eyes, and a dark suit. Detectives wanted every trace of evidence as quickly as possible, as outrage on the streets had grown fast. The postmortem was conducted by Dr. Moffat, with the police surgeon Anderson assisting. Their examination showed that pellets were embedded in Daniel's face and chest. After those were collected, it was put forward to the police that the young man had been shot with an ordinary 12-bore shotgun. A 12-bore shotgun, however, was a pretty common gun for those in rural areas around the city to own, as it was mainly used by farmers and their hands to shoot rabbits and hares. The shock of seeing her boyfriend murdered, and then being raped and abandoned, Marjorie was left in an utter state of shock and was bedbound. Her doctors would attend to her, and despite all that she had been through, the brave girl still pushed herself to help the investigation as much as possible. She was to attend the scene of the crime to reenact the events with her mother for emotional support, and she agreed that she would be available for any ID parades. Just 3 days after the murder, the first of these were to take place. Excitement was evident in the city after police were to visit a shop in central Perth and returning to the station with two men. The two men prepared for the parade, however, Marjorie was unable to identify the attacker. Now, one of the men, as a strange tidbit, was a motor driver by the name of Robert Hamill. He had twice already been detained by police in the recent years for murder, however, was innocent on both occasions and never charged. He'd just been pulled into Perth South Street Station at this time because he was an owner of a shotgun. As inquiries were made into the various gun shops in the area, more elaborate searches were conducted in the area of the Lover's Lane. To assist the officers on the ground, two airplanes had joined the search, swooping low over the hills. Yet this was not to bring the police any closer to the man who had murdered Danny. The appeals made within the press had started to bring forward more witnesses. Two campers from Aberdeen that were in the area on the 12th told police that they had heard at least two gunshots that evening. However, they believed it was someone shooting rabbits. By the 16th, things had seemingly moved further on, and interest from the public was still very large. Crowds had started to gather outside the county police station when a rumour had spread that men had been arrested in the Newburgh area. However, all those spoken to had solid alibis and were eliminated from the investigation. The interest in this case was very much fueled by the media. This was an advantage to the investigation, however, as many witnesses and tips were then telephoned into the station. One of these leads was reported by the two waitresses at the refreshment bar of Perth General Station. They were approached by a mysterious stranger on the night of the murder at work, who caused them worry due to his appearance and demeanour. They tried to speak with him, but he would not be drawn into conversation, and he left in a hurry for the last train going north towards the Highlands. Questions were asked why things had not progressed as quickly as possible, with the police issuing a statement that the investigation was particularly difficult, as without direct evidence, they couldn't create links to the murderer. The funeral of Daniel Kerrigan was to be held on Saturday, the 17th of August. The only mourners that were allowed to be in attendance at the request of the family were Daniel's mother, father, grandfather, Marjorie and her mother, and the teammates from his football club that he'd spent so many happy moments with. With that, though, it did not stop the crowds of people who lined the streets from his home on Union Lane to his final resting place at Welshall Cemetery. So many of those had come out along the old high street that reporters of the time noticed how there were scenes of mourners weeping at the loss of such a popular teen by an unknown assailant. Throughout the route, plain-clothed police officers were searching for anyone who stood out. By the graveside, David Fiskin, Danny's 70-year-old granddad, was to be seen to be notably upset when the coffin was lowered, overwhelmed as the baby he cared for was laid to rest. As Danny was being laid to rest, there was an incident that occurred that involved something akin to a citizen's arrest in the city centre. At 275 High Street was a shop occupied by Mr. Robert Farquhari. A small man was to enter and ask for 2 pence worth of roast beef. But when he was handed it, he informed the shopkeeper that he could not pay for it. Farquhari took a detailed look at the man and believed that he matched the description that had been aired in the appeals by police as the culprit. Quick on his feet, he smiled and told the man it was perfectly okay, and that the customer looked like he'd been on the road for some time. He welcomed the man into the back of the shop and gave him some hot tea, and scribbled a note for his assistant to call for the police whilst he kept him busy. The assistant left and returned with Deputy Chief Constable Patterson. The man was spoken to for a whole 3 minutes before being released. The next day, a rumour had spread late at night that the murderer himself had been traced and was currently on Reform Street. Hordes of people arose at the news, still wearing their bedclothes, and gathered on the paving stones. The man, however, had just been peeping through the windows, and Patterson was to attend the scene, calming the local residents before giving the man a stern warning and sending him off on the late bus home. The fact that there was so much publicity surrounding this case did come to use as the investigation seemed to slow. The Monday after the funeral, the police released further details of the crime that they had previously held back, which is a common tool used by police to ensure that they have the right person when they complete interviews. Further evidence made public came from details such as the handkerchiefs used in the crime, with the laundry mark M12 stamped upon it. There was also a penknife missing and a strip of barley found close to the body. The detectives told reporters that Danny had been robbed. His brown pocketbook that had his initials stamped on the corner of the flap had been stolen. Inside there was photos of Danny and Marjorie and a small amount of money, about 10 or 12 shillings. In the press on the 19th, there was also mention of the fact that Perth police did have to station a guard at the gravesite due to a number of people trying to take souvenirs from the site. House-to-house inquiries were still continuing and more messages came through to the station about possible suspects. There was a man described as a tramp who had been reported to the police. He was staying at a guest house and started to complain of head pains before rambling about the Perth murder, stating he knew all about it. The man was traced, yet ruled out. Another lead that led nowhere for detectives was a man from the city of Dundee. He tried to sell a 12-bore shotgun, the same type as used in the murder. He was traced and the gun examined. The gun itself was broken and in need of repair, which the gunsmith collaborated with the police. As I say, the publicity in this case, despite the false leads, did help the investigators progress. On the 20th of August, a group of amateur detectives travelled to the scene of the crime. They had been informed by the police that if anything was found, it must be left in place and that officers must be called. Marjorie's clothing, as I said, was never recovered from the area surrounding the wooden stile near Cherrybank. However, on this search, there were several swatches of material found that later were identified as the young woman's. Another great find in terms of the investigation was made by Robert Gardiner, a 13-year-old boy who had been riding his bicycle after leaving his home at 44 Eyre Street. He was 500 yards from the murder site when he came across the penknife that the police had been searching for. Real clues in regards to the identity of the man who had attacked the sweethearts were few and far between, however, and pressure was on Perth Police. The county police force didn't just put all their pennies on the same horse, so to speak. They were running many theories at the same time. A theory was published in the press on Thursday the 22nd after a statement from an officer that stated, "They were looking into a new hypothesis after information was shared by a witness." Somebody had come forward with a theory about a poaching exhibition, which would have been in the field adjacent to the part of the path that the couple were walking on. A witness that was just 200 yards from where the murder happened said, "I went out with my girl. I heard two shots ring out. I said it would likely be someone shooting rabbits. 10 minutes later, on our way home, I heard a third shot." With officials from Glasgow CID stepping in to help the officers from Perth, they were now hoping that this wasn't going to be left an unsolved case. It was time for harvest, which did give an opportunity for previously unseen clues to come to light, as crops in the surrounding fields were to be cut. The police spoke to all the farm holdings in the immediate area around the crime scene, asking for those employed as harvesters to keep an eye out and alert police if anything was to be uncovered. Nothing of note was to be found, however. It was also on the 23rd that a letter was to arrive in the hands of Marjorie that the police thought may have been of importance. The unsigned letter read as follows. "Dear Miss Fenwick, meet me at the General Station, Perth, at 6:30 on Saturday night. If you do not, you know. The man in the blue suit." The handwritten note in capital letters was shown to the police, who, that Saturday, surrounded the station in CID offices, looking for a man in a blue suit. Unfortunately, this was, like in many cases, just a dead lead by some prankster. Marjorie's face and address had been posted in numerous newspapers of the time, leading to a number of twattish-like people reaching out due to malice. Every investigation seems to have this sort of hindrance. Another incident that was later to be ruled unrelated was that a fire broke out just 50 yards from the crime scene on the 24th. Witnesses who were along Cuddy Strip on August 12th kept trickling in to the police, such as a man who came forward on Wednesday the 28th to say that he saw two men acting suspiciously behind the cover of the bushes near the path. This seemed to back the theory that was still being worked on that it could have been a shooting due to a poaching accident. Yet, with this theory, why was it only one man that attacked the 17-year-old girl with Daniel? And why would a poaching accident lead to a sexual assault? Come Thursday morning, some news had spread through the city, early in the morning, that led to much public excitement. Crowds of interested spectators started to gather around the South Street Police headquarters, beginning to gather at 9 a.m. Photos of the scene appeared in national newspapers the following morning and show how both sides of the street were completely blocked with people. More than 1,200 people had come awaiting news that an arrest had been made. And at some point that morning, someone who had attacked a beloved member of the city's community, was due to appear in court. Those standing outside saw a motor car with a terrified-looking Marjorie in the back seat, accompanied by her mother, trying to get past and to the station. So many people were in attendance that the car was blocked, and, worried a mob would start, she swiftly was driven through the back streets and entered the building through the back entrance. A few moments later, Inspector Davison stepped out of the front door and scanned the crowd, ignoring the calls for details of offence unfolding inside. It was 10:15 a.m. and the inspector moved through the crowd, selecting several men of a smaller stature to accompany him inside for an identity parade. So, how did the people of the Fair City, as it's been nicknamed, know that someone had been arrested? Well, outside the station doors arrived an older couple just after dawn. The woman had tears in her eyes, and they were not permitted into the station until 8:30 a.m. The couple were known as once being residents in Castle Gable, an area in the city, and it was clear for all the police efforts that their son must have been the culprit of the murder that shook Scotland. The man who'd been taken inside came out after 20 minutes, and moments passed before officers were to bring out another man, this time not from the crowd that had been asked to come into the station. The man that the police were surrounding was of a sallow complexion, with a slightly upturned nose, a thin face and long black hair, wearing a grey suit. The crowd mobbed the doors, and it would take 8 officers to bring order to the spectators, as they all tried to get a glimpse of the man. The courthouse was directly across the road from the station, a mere 15 yards away. It took more than 3 minutes to cross with 8 officers to bring the accused man through the crowd that had caused a human crush. No one was permitted inside the courthouse. Inside, the Honourable Sheriff Substitute Duncan McNabb was to call for the man to address himself. The man responded, his name being John McGugan, alias John Milligan, and further stated he was a farm labourer who resided in a bothy on the farm of Kirkton of Mailer. A bothy, for anyone who is unfamiliar, is a basic accommodation that is free of charge to use, as it's left unlocked and is a familiar sight around Scotland. John seemed completely disinterested or fazed by his appearance in court, showing no emotion as he was swiftly charged with murder and rape. His face barely moved as the sheriff announced he was to be remanded in Perth prison. The news that a man had been arrested and charged did give the police the breathing space they needed to really bring focus upon their investigation. Yet the pressure was not completely off the officers involved in the case. Throughout September, police used their time to gather further evidence and even conducted a 70-man search of the locality where John lived and the scene of the crime. This search, despite covering more than 10 miles of ground, did not heed any further clues. But it wasn't all doom and gloom for the investigation. On the 3rd of September, John was once again to appear in the court being represented by Mr. Campbell, this time to be charged with burglary. The young man looked ill as he stood for a few short minutes before being taken by car back to prison in the southeast of the city. The last time that John was to be seen by sheriffs in Perth was when his trial was to be set. The 24-year-old was to plead not guilty to the 4 charges put to him, and it was explained by the sheriff principal that the trial had been set for November 25th at the High Court in Edinburgh. He then went on to further explain to the accused, who was calm and had a bandage wrapped around the middle finger of his left hand, that it was expected to last 2 days, with 71 witnesses expected to testify. The trial of John McGugan was opened in the High Court of the Judiciary on November 25, 1935, with Lord Justice Clerk Lord Atkinson presiding. Although it was expected to last 2 days, the trial was actually to last 6. A crowd of over 200 had gathered in Parliament Square, with hopes to be allowed entry into the courtroom. If they managed to get inside, they saw the thick-set John being brought up from the cells by 2 police officers, wearing a new tweed suit and a freshly shaven face. The defendant was to plead not guilty to the 4 charges, them being murder, criminal assault, theft and robbery. The jury was sworn in of 8 women and 7 men before Mr. Albert Russell, King's counsel, for the prosecution was to open the case for the Crown. He explained there were over 106 exhibits and 71 witnesses to be called before the jury, and then outlined what exactly the police believed had happened. The accused, before the murder, had in fact broke into a home and stole some belongings. Those items had been taken from a locked room, and he'd broken in via a window of the laundry area. Some of these items were to be found at the crime scene, most specifically the handkerchief. Other items, which we will talk about in more detail later, were also found in the tent he lived in on the grounds of the farm. Russell explained to the jury that they would hear from witnesses that saw John, and later identified him in police parades, near the site of the crime, on the night of the murder. That witnesses would be heard that stated John had been in the possession of a shotgun, and one of the victims, who bore physical injury after the attack, that being Marjorie Fenwick. Mr. John Darling, a surveyor, was to give details about the location of the crime and showed with diagrams how close the defendant's tent home was to the crime scene. Just a mile away, located on numbers 115 and 124 of the Ordnance Survey sheet. Two young men, one being the son of a local farmer, was to testify to hearing gunshots on the night of the 12th of August. They were in the farmyard fixing a motorbike when they heard the shots. They both recognised it as a gunshot, but placed it to poachers. A ploughman that worked at Kirkton of Mailer, John Peddy, was to give damning evidence in regards to McGugan. He was to tell the judge and jury that during July of that year, he was shown a gun by the defendant and told him it was his. The gun was a double-barreled shotgun. He was asked about the night of the murder, in which, when the witness was walking with a friend on the fields, they passed McGugan's tent, and he was not in. The following day, Peddy caught up with John and asked where he'd been the night before, and then said, in a joking manner, "Did you go out shooting and accidentally shot the man?" John replied, not how Peddy had expected, strangely saying, "I thought you'd be thinking that." He said that he had hidden the gun because he had no license and was frightened for the police getting it. Another witness who worked with John was Ronald McKenzie. They had been working in a cornfield when a policeman cycled past them. John was noted to say, "They need not bother go up now. I have my gun away." The Crown's star witness, the surviving victim Marjorie, was also to take the stand. She appeared in the box, smartly dressed in a black tailored coat, a silk scarf, and a small black hat. She told the court she was 17 years of age, being born on March 14th, and that she had been dating the sporty Danny since New Year. Questioned about the night of August 12th, she said that Daniel had offered to take her to the pictures at King Cinema, but she didn't like Shirley Temple, so they'd gone for a walk before stopping to reminisce over photographs. The photographs led to a strange question by today's standards, but you can now see what was implied. Marjorie was asked if one of the photos were of the young couple embracing and kissing, to which she replied in the affirmative. She was then asked if they were engaged. She replied no. The young woman tried to keep her composure as she explained the first gunshot that made the couple turn, and then the second shot that left Danny by her feet. Marjorie, as she was being led through the testimony about her rape, became a little vague. She explained how she was taken from the stile, how she was dragged across to the bushes, and how she felt pressure on her neck, so pretended to faint so she wouldn't struggle. Marjorie was then told to go into more detail by the defence counsel, Mr. Burnett, King's counsel, She then, with a face of panic, addressed the Lord Justice, saying, "Must I tell this in public?" Lord Atchison did try to ease the situation for the teenager by asking her directly if he had tried to take advantage of her, to which she replied yes. He continued, "Did he succeed to?" which Marjorie repeated yes. Asked if she could identify the man whilst in court, she pointed to the dog. Witnesses such as the couple that first came across Marjorie also testified about the night in question, speaking of her utter distraught. The first officer on the scene that was to see Daniel Kerrigan's body told the jury how he found the young man, wearing a checked jacket, a blue sweater and grey flannel trousers, being laid on the ground with his head on the grass and his feet on the footpath. When Detective Inspector Davidson was to take the stand, he was to detail about how he found items from the robbery that could also be linked to the defendant on the night of the murder that were found in his residence during the search on the night of his arrest. This was a point of contention for the defence when being cross-examined. Burnett, for the defence, when cross-examining the witness, brought the subject of search warrants before the jury, stating that when Davidson searched the tent that the evidence was linked to, he did not in fact have a legal right to do so. Davidson agreed that on that night, August 28th, he attended John's home and found his parents already at the tent site. They did not bring any objection to the search or the fact that anything was taken as evidence. He also stated that on that night, it being late, he was worried that somebody who knew of the murder may have tried to destroy evidence. Lord Atchison was to ask when he did apply for a warrant, to which Davidson said the following morning, and the inspector was to expand on the point that when the search was carried out, that John had already been identified as the suspect and was arrested. The Lord Justice ruled that the evidence should stay, much to Burnett's anger. Sergeant Duncan McCallum was to step into the box to testify that when he was to help Marjorie on the night, she still had the handkerchief attached to her wrist. He was to say that it was tied very tight and that she would have had to struggle to get free. The gun that killed Daniel was never recovered in this case, but Constable William Nicol Kippen was to state that on the morning of August 15th, at sunrise, he found three cartridge wads near the scene, which were later sent for expert opinion. The expert opinion was given and testified in court by Alexander Martin of Glasgow, who had 20 years' experience. He told of how he'd examined the wads from the scene and examined photographs taken of Daniel during the post-mortem. He was to state that he believed the shot came from 8 yards to the right of the couple. Burnett crossed Mr. Martin and asked how Marjorie had escaped the pellets from the shotgun, to which the expert put to the court that she must have not been in direct line with the shot. When Davidson was on the stand, he had also spoken about the handkerchief that linked John from the robbery to the attack on Daniel and Marjorie. The handkerchief had the laundry mark in red thread stating M12, which was then linked to a laundry in Kelso, a town to the south of Perth. There were records from the laundry that stated they matched the marks in the books on January 11th and February 22nd, which was then traced to the house that the robbery had occurred. This was corroborated by officers in the court. The robbery had happened in a house which David Douglas lived in with his mother, and the items had been taken from his heavy luggage that had been left downstairs in the home. Other items taken were a long telescope and an alarm clock, which were later located in John's possession. The original owner, Mr. Douglas, confirmed to the court that they were in fact his items and stated the handkerchief was of significance in his mind, as it had been a gift from an Indian tradesman whilst he was in South Africa. Davidson expanded that John gave the police the excuse that he had come into owning these items after he'd bought them from a man he did not know, a travelling man who did not wish to carry them. However, forensic evidence proved this wrong. From the home of Mr. Douglas, the window frame was carefully removed and sent to Glasgow, where it was examined for fingerprints which had been recovered. The jury then heard on the 6th of September the head warden of Perth Prison, 52-year-old Robert White, was to take John's fingerprints using a copper plate system. They matched. The identity parade was also spoken about by Davidson, in which he recounted how Marjorie was to look down the line and leap when she saw the accused. She had pointed him out and moved closer for a second look. When she had done this, John addressed her, stating that she had got the wrong man and he just resembled the man. She was then asked for a second confirmation from an officer from Glasgow CID, Lieutenant Leith. One of the last witnesses for the prosecution was a witness that could place John at the scene of the crime, with a gun, on that summer evening. William Gow was a 50-year-old man who had spoken with John McGugan on the day for more than half an hour. The man testified that he was walking across a field near the wooden stile and looked up to the top of Woodhead Wood, where he spotted John perch with something like a gun pointed. He waited for 5 minutes as he watched the man from below. Suddenly, John jumped down and ran over a dike and perched a little lower whilst holding something to his eye. William waited and watched him for some more time before John moved down the hill and out of view. When the older man had reached the stile, he met John, and they approached one another. William noted that there was a couple to the left of them laid on the floor. John had a long telescope and a shotgun with him. William and John had spoken about poaching in their time together, William having partook in the illegal activity that day also, and John telling him the gun was unregistered. The younger man told William where he lived, and they also spoke about the local game before parting. William was asked by the Lord Justice if he had known the man beforehand, yet denied this, saying it was the first time they had met, and that he later positively identified him at a parade held at Perth Station on August 29th. Dr. Moffat was to give an outline of injuries sustained to Marjorie. He said that when he first examined the girl on the night of the attack, she was in a calm state of mind, but she had been the victim of a violent attack from the injuries shown on her body. She had a handprint mark on her throat, with bruising showing a right-handed person bruising both sides of her larynx. He spoke of her back being scratched and stated that they could have come from when she was being dragged from the stile along the undergrowth. He was cross-examined and asked why she only had localised injuries, that mainly being to the rear of her body. To which the doctor replied that there was no way she could have given the injuries to herself, stating, "From the examinations I made, I am of the opinion that the girl was forcibly assaulted." Moffat also spoke to the injuries to Kerrigan, stating he had pellet punches on the right side of his face and neck, and a significant amount of wounds to his chest on the left-hand side. He clarified the death would have been instant. More medical evidence was given by Dr. Anderson, who attended Miss Fenwick and assisted in the post-mortem. He was an experienced man and was asked by the Lord Justice, "In all your experience, have you ever known a case where a woman whose lover has been shot went on to pretend that she had been criminally assaulted?" The doctor simply replied, "No." With this, the Crown put the prosecution's case to rest. An audible gasp was heard, with many eyebrows raised, as Burnett announced that no evidence was to be led by the defence. And with that, came time for the closing speeches. Mr. Russell for the Crown stated to the jury that they needed to determine if Marjorie was telling the truth about the events that happened that night, and they could rely on her demeanour shown in court. He told them to remember that the evidence she gave was corroborated by witnesses and forensic evidence. Even though there was no direct witness to seeing John shoot Danny, Russell did repeat that witnesses had been called throughout the trial that pointed to seeing the accused with a shotgun on the day of the murder. For the defence, Burnett was to remind the jury that there was no motive in this case, and then did as many men of the time did, degrade a woman for speaking up. The main basis of his defence plan was to disregard the testimony given by Marjorie, and he closed with, "I don't say the girl was manufacturing evidence or making up a story, but I do say that while the major part of her story, the shooting of Kerrigan, is true, the whole of her story, as presented by her, is not one that you can accept implicitly at her hand. You must remember that although she has told the same general story from the beginning, she was, when first seen, a girl in a distressed and hysterical condition, and a man's life is not to be sworn away on the evidence of a hysterical girl." At the end of this, Lord Atchison was to sum up to the jury, stating, "Don't forget, when you are in the region of crime of this gravity, you are definitely in the region of the abnormal. People who commit crimes of this sort are not to be measured by ordinary standards. Also, remember the man who is capable of shooting Kerrigan dead in the presence of that young girl when they were sweethearting together was a man capable of any crime. There is no doubt whoever committed this crime was a man of low and degraded mentality." When the session resumed the next day, it only took the jury 2 hours and 10 minutes to return with a verdict. John McGugan was guilty of criminal assault and theft. On the murder charge, with a majority of 9-6, he was found not proven. The Scottish law courts allowed this verdict in a case where the jury believes the defendant could be guilty, however, the evidence is not strong enough. He was given a sentence of 10 years. This is a case very much an echo of how society was very much rigged against women, and how in a court sitting, an accusation of rape is battled by the defence, something that even today is a major issue. I came across this case from a book called Cuddy Strip by Rob McInroy. It tells of the case but in a fictionalised format, and it's riveting. If you want to read it, I highly recommend you do. You can order it via Amazon, Waterstones, and signed copies can be bought through Ringwood Publishing. Rob manages still to be able to tell the story of the crime with amazing accuracy, but there's something about how he brings to life the era through his fictional officers in the case. I know he's planning more, so if you like a good book, give it a read. It's now finally time for the promo of the week, and I'm just going to leave it to the smoothest voice from across the Atlantic, Hunter, with Murder and Such.
My name is Hunter, and I welcome you to Murder and Such, a podcast about murders, the macabre, true crime, serial killers, and other dark subject matter. Join me for the first 50 episodes where my co-host and I discuss some of the most well-known cases and some you've probably never heard of. Or join me after episode 51 for a much more serious approach to true crime. You can find Murder and Such on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and all of your podcatcher services. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Murder and Such. I hope to hear from you soon.
As always, you can find all that you need to support this favorite of mine in the show notes. So subscribe, rate, and review. And now on to the giveaway. 2020 has taken a lot from us, but it can't take away one of the best weekends of the year, CrimeCon. Since we can't travel to CrimeCon this year, CrimeCon is going to come to us, streaming right to our living rooms on Saturday, November 21st. From cold case mysteries to the latest in forensics, from how do you protect your family to how to tell if someone is lying, the schedule is incredible. And there's so many speakers and true crime podcasters. The best part is that you can now join in from your living room. It all happens on Saturday, November 21st. Just go to crimecon.com/housearrest and enter the code LADY to save 10% off the badge of your choice. That's crimecon.com/housearrest. This being said, I am lucky enough to not only be attending this, but I've got a ticket to give away to one of you beautiful humans for free. Details will be released on Sunday the 15th of November all over the show's social media. So come and get involved and the giveaway will be super simple to enter. With that, it's the end of the episode and I want to see if we can balance out those scales somewhat with a small act of kindness. This week, my suggestion is to be kind to yourself, as you can't keep pouring from an empty glass, or so they say. Try writing down just a couple of things that you're grateful for, or that you've achieved every night, whether in a journal or in a Word document. Research shows this actually increases our happiness by a whopping 25%, and after this year, we all need a little boost. So, go be good people, go be kind, go be safe, and most importantly, go be happy.